welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. And we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 to noon or reach us through restaurantguysradio.com.
Or you can check us out on iTunes. We're now iPodcasting. We are podcasting, and you can go to iTunes, and we're throwing up a couple of shows a week just on iTunes.
So and lots of people are there. Downloading us on their iPod. That's really cool.
We
may actually have to buy one.
we were getting hundreds of people a day downloading our show.
Who want to listen to us?
Thanks for listening, everybody.
You want to come work for us because they don't listen to us at all.
I want to talk about something that appeared in the news a while back, way back in April. There's a place that got some press, and I think it's a real. And I did a little research on it, and I came up with it's really true. And I think we got to share this with the folks.
Okay.
The Restaurant Guy's perspective on Beef and Guns, A Night Out in New York.
Now, Beef and Guns, A Night Out in Texas.
No.
I hear you.
Beef and Guns, A Night Out in New York.
Doesn't sound like a good idea to me.
Here's what it is. The evening begins at a 40-year-old firing range on West 20th Street, where participants learn basic rifle safety before loading a .22-caliber rifle and shooting away at a bullseye for the better part of an hour. Then it's off to Frank's, an old-school steakhouse in the Meatpacking District that opened in 1912 when the neighborhood was known as a meat market for the stuff served on plates. An appetizer and a steak are included with the loaner rifle, 150 bullets at $98 a head.
So it's like shoot your own cow?
No, it's just shoot and eat beef. So and of course they have the picture that ran in an article in the New York Times. It's great. It shows these two pretty hot chicks, you know, with their rifles. Shooting at the cameraman, so it would seem. I love that.
I got to tell you.
That's a new pre-fee, man.
There is something about shooting a gun, and I can't explain it. You know, I'm totally not the kind of guy who you think you're really not the guy who you think who would really enjoy something like that.
I used to go hunting with my dad when I was a kid.
I know. But
love it.
But to look at you, you wouldn't think that that's what you were doing.
You think you better have a gun if you're coming after me.
But there's something really basic about that.
Fulfilling about firing off
about
that much
shooting
power.
Shooting a gun and blowing things up. I don't know. I'm a guy. I got too much testosterone. I have no idea why.
Well, and of course.
And then you want to eat big beef. It makes total sense.
Yeah, it really
does.
Give me
a big raw steak.
You know what else you say?
Don't even cook it. Just bring it out.
There's something very basic and fulfilling or something very basic and appealing about shooting a gun. And I'm looking at this picture. And there's something sort of basic and fulfilling about two, like, trendy downtown New York chicks shooting rifles and going after a big steak.
You have issues, man.
Their numbers aren't listed here in the article anyway.
Oh,
wonder if I call the Times.
Times, if they'll give that information out.
You know,
I bet they won't.
I think that's really very interesting and very basic, but shooting guns in New York, that's a little spooky.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, though, something that really surprises me about something like that. Usually you figure those things are kind of gimmicky types of things to bring people to restaurants. Frank's is a real steakhouse. It's a really, really good steakhouse.
Bring out the spirit of full disclosure. We've been going to Frank's for years. We used to belong to a lunch club, which is mostly chefs and restaurateurs and wine buyers and cool people, mostly in New York. I think, Mark, you and I were the only guys who live in Jersey who were members. And we would go to lunch at a different steakhouse on the second Monday of every month, because who can go out on Mondays for lunch? And this lunch wasn't like a one-hour get-back-to-the-office lunch. And we would order red meat, rare, and we mean it. We'd order big bottles of wine. We'd smoke cigars, because back then you could smoke cigars in Manhattan.
And never go to work.
And not go to work until the next day. And sometimes those lunches would last until 2 o'clock in the morning. But they always started about being about the meat. And we went. This club met for 10 years, and then it was disbanded on its 10th anniversary. It was a beautiful thing. But I remember we went. The rules of the club were you showed up at 11:30 and you sat at between 11:30 and 12, and you sat at 12:30. And we showed up at Frank's Steakhouse in Manhattan, which is still there. It's in a different location now, just slightly different location. And
still down in the Meatpacking District.
Yeah, just a block away from where it was before. The Molinari family owns Frank's, and Frank's son Jimmy Molinari is our friend who runs the place. And I remember we hadn't met them yet, and we arrived early, and it's 11:30 in the morning, and I walked in with my friend Fred Price. And we were the first there, and there's sawdust on the floor. There's, like, beef blood congealed in some of the sawdust. It's a beautiful, it's just a great old space. And there are guys smoking cigars and drinking grappa at 11:30 in the morning.
11:30, 11:45. And they're not just drinking. Okay, they're pounding.
And they got like a big table, and it's obviously they've just finished dessert and espresso, and I'm thinking, who the hell? I mean, I'm
11:30.
I'm hardcore. But you're on cigars and grappa at 11:30 a.m. And what it turned out was that Frank's, and we'll put Frank's website up on our website, Restaurant Guys Radio, a little bit later on. But Frank's Steakhouse, run by really nice people, the Molinari's, they serve the people who work in the meatpacking district. Before the meatpacking district had all these trendy club kids walking around, getting into the C and B scene places.
My guess is those meatpackers don't like those trendy club kids too much.
It's not an exact fit there. But we went down to the meatpacking district when it was just that, a place where most of the meat was fabricated in New York, and the meat packers would get off at their 6 a.m. shift, the overnight shift, and then they go to Frank's and have dinner. So you know this place had good steak because these are the guys.
These are the meat packers.
And so that was great. We used to go there all the time. And I remember we talked to Jimmy. I learned a lot from Jimmy because they hang their own meats. They dry their own prosciutto there.
Yeah.
And we talked with Jimmy about how he dries prosciutto because we were sort of getting into making our own cured hams and the like. And there's an art to it, and there's a certain amount of science to it as well. But what happened with Jimmy was he would hang the meat by the cycles of the moon, which is how his grandfather had done it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, he didn't count the days. He didn't have the exact times. He said, oh, well, he did it by the moon. And I thought, that's very cool. And the prosciutto was, of course, extraordinary.
Right. Well, you always want to, you want to go to the place where the ethnicity eats, okay? You want to go to the Italian restaurant with the Italian people at it. You want to go to the Chinese restaurant with the Chinese people at it. You want to go to the Japanese restaurant with the Japanese people at it. And you want to go to the meat, the steak house where the meat packers are, because you're guaranteed that's where the highest quality stuff's going to be, because those are the people who know exactly what it's supposed to be like. And one of the things about Frank's that I really enjoyed as well was Frank's had great pasta. But, it's rarely do you go, usually you go to those places and it's steak and nothing else, and you don't want to eat anything but steak. You got it. But at Frank's, he actually had some really, really good pastas.
One of the reasons that they do this is because Jimmy's mom is overseeing the very traditional.
And Jimmy's name is Molinari. So that works out pretty well for the pasta.
And they don't own an Irish pub, do they?
No, they own a great steakhouse where some awesome, awesome ravioli and things are served.
We'll be back in a moment. We're going to talk to a gentleman who's written a book about mad cow disease. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, and we are here talking about mad cow disease, and we're here talking with John Stauber, who's written a book called Mad Cow USA, which scared the tar out of me and will do the same to you when you go and read it. And we'll tell you how you can get it by putting it up on our website later on. That's www.restaurantguysradio.com. John Stauber is also the executive director and founder of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, and he joins us today to talk about the situation of beef in the United States and actually in the Western world. Hello, John.
John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Thanks very much for coming to talk with us and writing this book. In the foreword of your book, which is kind of wonderfully entitled How Now, Mad Cow, your book was originally published in 1997, and you started with the Could the Nightmare Happen Here? was one of the questions you posited back then. And, of course, in December 2003, Ann Veneman announced that Mad Cow had been found in the United States. How did you react when all of your alarms were not heeded and, indeed, mad cow did come to the United States, even though they told us it couldn't?
I was outraged. I was really outraged, but I unfortunately wasn't surprised because, as you point out, in Mad Cow USA, which Sheldon Rampton and I wrote and wrapped up in the fall of 1997, we said that the steps that need to be taken to prevent the spread of mad cow disease here in the U.S., this horrific, fatal dementia disease that kills cattle and people, the steps to prevent it had not been taken and were not being taken. And it was just a matter of time before we were going to develop mad cow disease. And the United States.
Right. Yeah, see, I guess that's where I differ. I wasn't outraged in 2003. I was outraged in 97.
Yeah.
And I was outraged in 98 when we didn't change things again, and in 99 when we didn't change things again. For me, in 2003, when we had that first case of mad cow in the United States, I was like, of course we did. Sooner or later, it was going to happen.
I'll tell you what really stunned me, though, is that I'm a pretty cynical guy. You know, I'm an investigative reporter who investigates PR spin, propaganda coming from big corporations and government agencies. I'm pretty skeptical. But Sheldon and I really thought that when mad cow disease came to the United States, finally, that would force the government and the big meat industry lobby groups like the American Meat Institute and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and the American Feed Industry Association to change their tune and do the right thing, because this is a relatively easy problem to fix. You stop feeding any animal protein to livestock, and you do testing to keep infected animals out of the food supply, and we've still not taken those steps.
Now,
that does seem pretty logical, doesn't it?
Very logical.
Not to feed the vegetarian animals meat products, and especially not to feed them their own meat products, not to make them cannibals?
And what's very infuriating is, of course, we're being told consistently by the Secretary of Agriculture, Mike Johanns, top veterinarians like John Clifford, by the leaders of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, that these feeding practices have stopped. And frankly, that's a lie. When the USDA says we no longer feed ruminant protein to ruminants, that's untrue. As we point out, in 1997, gaping loopholes, they're still allowing calves to be weaned on cattle blood, even though blood transmits mad cow disease in the laboratory.
What do they call it when they give the calves blood to the... That it's almost like the mother's milk. That's
that's right. That's, can you
it's
imagine?
Almost like the mother's milk, except it's her blood.
Like the mother's milk, if you were a vampire.
Now let's establish something. I want to
milk replacer. That's what they call it.
I want to establish some ground rules, and I want to explain things very clearly to people, because a lot of people are listening to this garbage that's coming out of the Department of Agriculture. And you know, Ann Veneman, just every time she opens her mouth, like another animal product would come out. You know what I mean? That was just. I mean, she was a former Secretary of Agriculture who was Secretary of Agriculture when we finally did find mad cow disease, and she kind of poo-pooed it as not important, and, it's all contained, and said, we haven't
actually,
found...
Actually, poo-pooing it, I believe, is E. coli.
Well, and she said, we haven't found any incidence of mad cow disease other than this one, and we're looking everywhere except in other cows to find it, But this was preventable, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this was 100% preventable. Mad cow did not have to come to the United States.
That's right. We now know that it probably came here more than a decade ago, probably in the early 90s. But in our book, we have an internal document from the USDA way back in 1990 saying in order to stop it from coming here, we need to stop the feeding of cattle to cattle, but that would inconvenience the rendering and livestock industries. So they never did inconvenience those industries. They're still not inconveniencing them, and here we are having been amplifying and spreading the disease for probably a decade in North America.
But, John, I guess what really is disturbing about this for me, I'm not a scientist, okay? But it seems so logical to me that you shouldn't feed a cow a cow, and that you shouldn't feed a vegetarian meat. It just, if they're not omnivores, they're vegetarian. They're vegetarians. They're herbivores.
Right.
Why? Who thought that was a good idea?
Well, this idea that cattle are being fed ground-up cattle really came out of the agribusiness industry a couple decades ago. Half of every animal slaughtered is unfit for human consumption, gets shipped off to the rendering plant. And when you're slaughtering 35 or 36 million cattle alone a year in the United States, that's an amazing amount of biological waste.
We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with John Stauber, who is the author of Mad Cow USA and the executive director and founder of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. Our subject is mad cow disease, and John is probably one of the most knowledgeable people and one of the early alarmists to talk about this subject. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 1125. Restaurant Guys, and we are here talking with John Stauber, who's author of Mad Cow USA, which is a book about mad cow disease. And we've been talking about how we, though we've known for many years what it would take to stop mad cow disease, that would be very expensive to the beef industry, and so we haven't done it. Now, you said earlier that we spent the last 10 years amplifying and spreading a disease that was here, though we knew it, because mad cow's a subacute or a slow infection. And it takes up to 40 years sometimes for it to show up in human beings. Is that correct?
That's essentially correct. This is an extremely bizarre disease. It's called a prion disease or a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy.
You got to tell us what that means. Sorry.
Yes, a TSE disease, a prion disease. Prion is an infectious protein. And this type of disease, mad cow disease in cattle, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or CJD in people, scrapie in sheep, and there are other species that get similar diseases, is extremely unusual because these are diseases that are actually spread through infectious proteins. And the way mad cow disease emerged and was noticed was that way back in 1985, Britain saw the first mad cows. And they couldn't figure out what was going on, but they quickly realized this is a disease like scrapie in sheep. This is a disease like CJD in people. This is a prion disease.
Yeah, and it affects your brain. I mean, that's...
It's a 100% fatal dementia with a long invisible latency period in people. The latency period we know can last for decades, even as long as 40 years. And so there are millions and millions of people who were exposed to infected cattle in Britain. Luckily, today, 20 years after we first noticed this emerging in cattle, the deaths worldwide are only 160 people. That's sort of the good news. The bad news is that because the disease can sit invisible for decades and because we only first confirmed human deaths 10 years ago, we don't know how many people might be carrying the disease, and there's no test right now that can be done for it. And that's why if you go to your local Red Cross and try to give blood, they'll ask you a series of questions. And if you were in Britain at the height of the mad cow epidemic, mm-hmm. they'll say, we're sorry, we'd love to accept your blood, but we can't because you might be an invisible incubator of mad cow disease.
And we can't even test it. And we're going to talk more about how indestructible this virus is and how dangerous it is and how hard it is to track and even know about this latent virus when we come back from the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon or just through restaurantguysradio.com. Today we're talking about a less fun subject than we normally talk about.
But an important one.
And a really important one. And it's mad cow disease. And with us we have John Stauber, who wrote a book called Mad Cow USA, and is executive director and founder of the Center for Media and Democracy out in Madison, Wisconsin. John, a little while ago we were talking about some of the ways that we saw mad cow appearing and when we saw it appear. What can we do now, today, to prevent this kind of thing from continuing to spread?
Well, the good news is we know exactly what to do. The bad news is we're not doing it, but we're being told it's being done. So we're sort of in the worst of all situations.
Right.
Here's what we can do. Britain was amazed when they saw this dementia disease emerging in cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And behind closed doors, the British government said, well, where did this come from? We've seen this in sheep. We've seen it in people, but not in cattle. And if it's in cattle, maybe it can get into people, however it got into cattle. But rather than being forthright and saying, we've never seen this disease in cattle before, they spent a decade assuring the British public that it could never move into people. They learned very quickly, by 1988, how the disease would spread. Slaughterhouse waste was turned into cheap fat and protein supplements and being fed back to cattle. Cattle were eating cattle. That was amplifying and spreading this horrible dementia.
Now, why did they do that? Just to get rid of the waste or to make the cows grow faster? What was the purpose of that?
Well, the purpose of it was to have a really cheap source of fat and protein. And for the cattle industry, right, you hit it on the head. There's a dual purpose. For one thing, this waste product, slaughterhouse waste, is difficult to get rid of. So if you can take a waste product that you might have to pay to dispose of and turn it into animal feed as fat and protein supplements, bingo, you're winning on both ends.
Mm-hmm.
But what they didn't anticipate was this bizarre infectious protein called a prion. Now, by 1988, Britain realized, oh, it's a disease being spread through the feeding, and they began cutting back and eventually banning the feeding of animal protein to livestock. The bad news is it took them well over a decade to really get totally strict about this.
Incredible.
And in the meantime, they exported their contaminated feed
just incredible.
All over the world.
10 years to stop that
of
problem.
Poisoning people.
Just 10 years of knowing what's wrong and not fixing it.
They were, now, I have to say that finally the Brits got it right. And what's, I think, even more outrageous is that here in the U.S., we could have learned from their mistakes, as I mentioned earlier, through a Freedom of Information Act investigation. I obtained an internal document from the USDA way back in 1990, where they're saying, look, in order to head this off in the U.S., we should be stopping feeding cattle to cattle, but we're not going to do it.
But that's expensive.
So what's going on here? What do we need to do to stop the spread of the disease? Very easy. We can learn from what Britain, all the other EU countries, Japan have done. Total ban. We need a total ban on feeding animal protein to livestock. That stops the amplification and spread of the disease. And then we also need to food safety test cattle before they go
right
to human consumption. Now, countries that do this find it costs somewhere between 3 cents to 6 cents per pound of meat to safety test.
You know what's incredible?
But they tell us that we are testing.
Well, we're not. They'll say, but we're not safety testing. They really have a testing program here that I think has been designed to not find the disease and to cover it up. And
mm-hmm.
What's shocking about this second mad cow that they've discovered, the Texas mad cow that was born in Texas, raised in Texas, is that they identified this animal as almost certainly having mad cow disease last November. Then they tested it at the USDA lab, they being the USDA, at their lab in Iowa, and said, oh, guess what, it doesn't have mad cow disease. They
right
refused to do the gold standard test, the Western blot test. Their own inspector general, Phyllis Fong at the USDA, apparently went around the Secretary of Agriculture, got the correct test done, and we found out in June, that November cow was a mad cow.
Well, I think it's funny people got mad at her for going around and retesting that cow.
Isn't that incredible?
It's...
Yeah, she, if you could have just kept the cover-up going, Phyllis, incredible.
Well, you know what's crazy? It's like we find that there's mad cow disease, and the way that the Agriculture Department, they're so in the pocket of the meat industry that the way they respond to actual mad cow disease being found, which can cause terrible things, and we're going to talk a little bit later about what this does when it comes into human beings,
mm-hmm.
we're met with a public relations campaign.
Absolutely.
When they could spend the same amount of money and just fix the darn problem.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to read some things from your book that were really scary about this disease. And these are some things.
Oh, good, because the show hasn't been scary enough yet. Let's scare it up a little bit.
You write that
we'll do the show on Halloween next year.
You can't filter for it because of the nature of the disease, and we'll talk about the nature of the protein itself. It's too small. It doesn't have a DNA or an RNA. It's just a folded protein, so it's so tiny you can't filter for it. It's so small it can survive bombardment by radiation, capable of destroying DNA and RNA. The similar Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is the human form, has been passed from one patient to another on surgical equipment that had been sterilized in 70% alcohol. You write that of the similar disease, which is the scrapie, infected sheep's brains remain infective after being boiled for 30 minutes. The disease is resistant to bleach, other solvents, detergents, and enzymes that destroy most known viruses. And the scrapie can survive for 1 hour at 360 degrees Fahrenheit, which is adequate to melt lead.
Yeah, a lot of people think, well, you know, this is like E. coli.
I'll
burn the heck out of this piece of meat and
right
that'll take care of it. But what they've done in scientific tests is they've reduced infected material to ash and found infectivity in the ash. So
yeah,
this is,
I was just about to say,
emerging disease It needs to be dealt with through sound science and precautionary approaches, and we're being absolutely reckless here in fooling the public about it.
Nobody's cooking their burgers at 360 degrees for an hour.
You want to hear?
I mean, on the inside, you're not getting into that temperature ever.
Well, you want, but it doesn't matter how hot you cook.
That's
you're
what
not,
I'm
you're not
doesn't
to get
matter.
Rid of it by cooking. They're also cited an example in your book where a gentleman took an infected hamster brain mixed with soil, packed into pots, buried it in his backyard for 3 years, dug it up 3 years later, and discovered it was still infective. So what does this say? Even when you kill the mad cows, the ground in which you bury them remains infected.
I know. It's a problem that we've only begun to deal with and appreciate and understand. And yet again, it comes back to something so simple. Okay, what do we need to do? Stop feeding slaughterhouse waste, animal protein back to livestock, and test millions of animals. Britain has licked this. The EU nations have licked this. Japan has licked it. Apparently, we're not smart enough here in the United States and Canada to figure out what to do. Well, obviously, we are smart enough, but the problem is that this public relations campaign of the USDA and the biggest players in the meat and livestock industry have told the public these steps have been taken when they haven't been taken.
Yeah, I love they talk about voluntary bans. If it's voluntary, it's not a ban. Get it? But now, just so we can sort of do the real public relations, the anti-public relations campaign, the truth campaign, I think that a lot of people think, oh, well, mad cow disease, you know, when I'm 40, I'll start to forget things and I might be demented anyway. What really happens to people who have the variant form of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease that's caused by eating a mad cow?
Well, this is just a horrific disease. It's 100% fatal. I've spoken with many families who've lost members to this disease. And what happens to a human being is all of a sudden it's almost like a senility, a forgetfulness. People are out driving and they can't remember where they're going or where they came from. And what's happening is this disease that's been incubating for years or decades in them is now eating the brain with holes and plaque, and that process just continues for a matter of months, sometimes years, depending on how long it progresses. And death is inevitable. There's no cure, and it's a horrific death through dementia, debilitation, coma, a long, long weeks of usually home care for patients who are not going to do anything but eventually mercifully die.
And I just want to make a juxtaposition here. You said, what, 4 or 5 cents a pound?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, 4 or 5 cents a pound.
And, you know, here's another example of an outrage. There are companies like Creekstone, a meatpacking plant out of Arkansas.
Actually, we're going to find out about Creekstone in just a moment. We have to take a small break, but we'll be back in just a moment speaking to John Stauber, author of Mad Cow USA. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, and the time is 11:45. Back with the Restaurant Guys, and we're talking to John Stauber, author of Mad Cow USA and the executive director and founder of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. He's written this great book on mad cow disease, and we were talking just a little bit before the break about some examples of some things that have really gone awry with a company called Creekstone you were about to tell us. Please continue with that.
Creekstone is a company, a meatpacking plant in Arkansas with a really progressive owner, and on December 23rd, 2003, when the first mad cow was discovered in the United States in the state of Washington, most of the U.S. beef export just stopped as countries like Japan and South Korea
just banned American beef.
Rightly said, you know, I'm sorry, you've got mad cow disease, you got that fixed, we're not going to take any more of your beef until you do. Well, this was, has been a disaster, as you can imagine, for meatpacking plants, and Creekstone, an independent company in Arkansas with a real sharp executive whose name escapes me at the moment, went to the Japanese and said, how about this? We'll test every animal, and we'll only ship to you animals that are tested to your scientific specifications. Would you then accept our beef again and let us rehire our laid-off workers and get the show on the road? And the Japanese were completely amenable, and they said,
it's a great idea.
You set up a state-of-the-art testing lab, you send us the beef that are tested free of the disease, and we'll take it. Guess what? The U.S.
So what went wrong there?
The U.S. government steps in and says to Creekstone, if you do that, we're going to take you into a court of law. It's illegal in the United States for you to do that. We consider it illegal under a 1913 law for anyone but the USDA to test for mad cow disease.
Yeah, this has been my new favorite law, that it's against the law to test for mad cow.
Well, that's because the bastards who are trying to sell you, who don't want to do the testing, also don't want to let anybody else do the testing. So they want to preserve their market share, and they'll talk to you about, oh, the free market, the free market, the free market. Well, the free market says,
right.
"Hey,
you
listen,
we'll give you more money for. We'll give you more. It costs you more money. We'll pay you more money for beef that's been tested, but the government is saying you can't do that.
Because the government
saying ludicrous.
Because the government saying we're going to protect the large agribusiness firms that pay our lobbyists, and that's what they're going to say.
Yeah, because my goodness, Tyson and Swift and Cargill might suddenly see that there's not just a foreign but a domestic demand for 3 to 6 cents a pound more for beef that's been tested as coming from animals free of the disease, and my goodness, they might actually have to lose some market share to a public that's getting something they prefer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine that. I mean, you know, one of the major problems, one of the underlying problems that I know Eric Schlosser wrote a forward to your book, or at least endorsed your book. Eric Schlosser wrote Fast Food Nation.
Yeah.
And one of the points that he brings up in Fast Food Nation is he says, you know, the beef industry is so in the beef regulators, the Department of Agriculture is so in the pocket of the beef industry, almost unlike any other part of the economy. The USDA is supposed to regulate the beef industry, but at the same time promote the beef industry. And, you know, Ann Veneman, who was the Secretary of Agriculture in the beginning of this whole thing, I mean, what a real toady she was. I mean, and the deaths of innocent children are on her hands, okay? The blood of innocent children is definitely on her hands. And, you know, I care about food, and I'm not a vegetarian, and I like beef.
Like to eat beef. Really enjoy it.
But when you step in and not only don't do your job and don't cause the testing of beef to a potentially dangerous food, maybe it's not dangerous. Maybe you're right. Maybe the voodoo science that you use is fine. But then if that's the case, why wouldn't you let a private sector person offer tested?
I think the one reason they're saying it's illegal to test, too, is they just don't want to see more animals tested because this is a very invisible disease, and we know from the experience in Europe that countries like Germany said, we don't have it, we don't have it. And then private testing helped reveal the extent of it there. So, you know, if you do more testing, you're going to find more of the disease, and there's going to be more of a public demand for a ban on this type of feeding.
But all we have to do is test. I mean, that's really the answer. John, do me a favor. We're closing towards the end of our show today, and there's so much that we haven't touched on today. I would love it if you would come back maybe and do a show with us tomorrow. And if you have the time, and maybe we can spend some time telling people what they can do to safeguard the beef that they're eating and steps that they can take to get themselves some safe beef and some beef that they can feel good about putting on the table for their family.
Sure, thanks. I'd be happy to.
Great. We'll do that, and we'll also, when we come back, we'll talk about like where in the government, where we can have people apply a little pressure to the legislators, and you know where we can sort of demand some response from our legislators and the people who are responsible for protecting us and for protecting our children. And we're also going to talk a little bit more about the science of the disease, which I think is pretty interesting.
Yeah, this whole situation seems to me just ludicrous that we haven't solved this problem completely. Just it's crazy. I mean, it's actually crazy that we haven't that there's still meat product being served to our cattle 20 years later after we know it's a problem.
Well, you know, Mark, the fact of the matter is it's not crazy, it's corrupt. And I mean, let's call a spade a spade. I mean, we have like John said, we know what the problem is. We know how to solve the advantage that we have over England is we know how to solve the problem. Right. We should learn from their mistakes. And we purposefully, even though we've seen them make those mistakes, are not learning from those mistakes. And I recommend this book to everyone. So you should really go and pick it up. It's called Mad Cow USA. It was written in 1997. It has a more recent foreword. It's written by John Stauber, who was our guest today and will again be our guest tomorrow. And you can find out more specifics and click right through and buy that on our website, www.restaurantguysradio.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we've been talking about mad cow disease, and it scared the bejesus out of me.
I'm mad. Mad restaurant guy disease.
Just got to change the way we do things. And we're going to talk some more about mad cow tomorrow.
There is safe beef out there. Don't let this scare you away from all beef. But there is safe beef out there. But we need to, number one, make sure that we're buying safe beef whenever we can. And number two, put pressure on our government to actually do its job.
And remember, there's only been 150 cases of this worldwide. This is not an epidemic yet, but we need to stop it from becoming one.
We cannot put our head in the sand. You know, can we talk about a lighter subject?
Yes, I'm begging you.
Okay. I read that Ruby Tuesdays is offering a burger guarantee. And Ruby Tuesdays...
Oh, they're offering a guarantee.
Oh, yeah, money-back guarantee, so they say. But it's not exactly your money you get back.
Okay, go ahead.
Listen to this. I love this. Now, Ruby Tuesdays is not exactly my favorite chain. Not that I like chains at all, but Ruby Tuesdays is not my favorite.
Not high on the list, I agree.
Dateline Maryville, Tennessee. Ruby Tuesday has extended a money-back guarantee to its just-expanded line of burgers. Customers disappointed with the burger can replace it with one of equal or lesser cost, the chain explained in their press release.
That's not my money. You didn't give me my money back.
So if you don't like your burger, you can
we'll
have
give
another
more.
One.
This is terrible. Have another. That's
I wonder,
awesome.
Does that apply to the second burger, too? Like, if you don't, can you just stand there all day and keep getting
and
burgers?
Hate, and get hate,
hate
burgers
that,
all
hate
day.
That, hate that. Give me another one. Give me
that's,
another one.
That's not a money-back guarantee. Dude, I hated it. So you made me have another one.
Yeah, I
that
agree.
Seems like punishment. It doesn't seem like a reward.
You know, I have to say, and I am a big burger fan. We do a great burger.
I love great burgers. There's nothing like it.
And the key to a great burger, here's a rule. I just came back from house, some relatives' houses, and they were doing a lot of bad things to the burgers. When you make a burger at home, make it nice and thick. And if you're doing burgers on the grill, salt and pepper them aggressively.
Before you begin cooking them.
Before you begin cooking them, and turn them only once. Don't do that smashy down thing that makes the fire
thing.
Come up.
Definitely don't do that.
Because you know what you're doing? You're squishing all the juice out of there, man.
Definitely don't do that.
That cow.
Little secret. Yeah. Little secret for everyone.
Yeah.
Before you toast that bun, just a little skitch of butter.
Oh,
just
see, I don't do that.
Teeny little
you're
bit.
More decadent than
oh,
I am.
Oh, delicious.
But touch the get away from that burger, okay? You flip it only once when you see the blood coming up at the top, and you cook it till it's done, and then you're done. Leave it alone. Well, I hope that you've enjoyed the show. We've had a lot of useful information, and we're going to come back tomorrow and talk more with John Stauber about his book, Mad Cow USA. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, and the time is 12 noon.